It looks like the Ukraine-Russian war is now just basically a war against the civilian population. Ukraine hit a major thermal power plant in the city of Belgorod, knocking out one third of the city's power. It's basically, you know, civilian population. And I saw one Russian expert, a guy named Mark Gelati, University College of London. Power outage in Russian cities are not just a military problem. They're a political one. Putin needs to maintain the perception of control and stability. If ordinary Russians start facing rolling blackouts in major urban centers, the Kremlin's narrative of strength unravels. I know you and I have talked about the military realities of Ukraine and Russia. Russia is got more arms, they got more soldiers, they got more weapons. Clearly the larger military power, but behind every military, there is a civilian population that does have a political perception of this. What's your temperature reading on the Russian people? Their children are the ones that are dying in this conflict. I don't know that they are interested in, you know, rebuilding the former Soviet Union's might. Putin obviously is. I mean, he would love to go back to the old days of the Eastern Bloc nations, but do they really have the Russian people? Do they feel like they have a dog in this fight, that it's worth all the money that's being and the lives that are lost in this conflict?
You know, first of all, let me start off with one of your secondary comments there about what Russia wants, because it's routinely repeated in the West, the things that you just mentioned there about what Russia wants. But when you listen to what the Russians actually say, they do not want a return to the Soviet Union. As a matter of fact, Dmitry Medvedev, again, just I think 48 hours ago, said it's ludicrous to suggest that we want to recreate anything. He said, why would Russia want to go and take over militarily a decrepit Europe, or, you know, the people that are already having so much trouble economically? It would be nothing but a drain on our country. Well, you can add France to that, of course, or Germany, etc. Yes. He said, why would we want to add that headache to us? We gain nothing from it. We have no interest in it. And they don't have a military capacity capable of even doing it if they wanted to. So I think that's a first point. The second point is, and I know we would love to say that because of these increasing strikes, and they definitely are increasing in both quantity and effectiveness inside of Russia, and it is no kidding starting to cause some problems inside the country. But we want that to say that, oh, well, as soon as the people see this, then they'll lose confidence in Russia, and then it'll be like the U.S. and Vietnam, and they'll get tired of it, and then they'll quit. But I think that the much more likely outcome would be the exact opposite, that
really?
It's going to show the Russian people that I've been telling, Russia would say, I've been telling you from the beginning, this is the entire West waging war against us through the vehicle of Ukraine. And now then they're ramping this up. So we need to double down and increase our fight. There has been a lot of people, both in the military, openly have been saying this in some cases, that, you know, they're upset at Putin, not because he's waging the war, but because he's not waging the war hard enough. They're saying, you know, forget about this nibbling stuff. We have this huge reserve. You said 300,000. Why are you not using it? So they're starting to get aggravated that he's not pushing hard enough. So we may find that if we push and this starts to have enough success, that it could perversely cause Russia to expand its offensive operation inside of Ukraine. And by the way, at the same time this is happening in Russia, it is happening on a much higher scale in Ukraine. And they are facing a dire situation, especially as we get into the winter months here, because so much of their oil infrastructure, their electric power generation capacity, their transportation system have all continued to take big hits, like last night with a 600 round shot from the air. So this is now expanding beyond just the front lines, but now it's really expanding into the strategic view as well on both sides. And this is what modern war looks like.
Excellent analysis and excellent points you make in retort to my summary of where I think things are. Not where I think, right? Just where my perception of things are. So I have you, Daniel Davis. But let me ask you this. You and I talk about the relative strength, Russia versus Ukraine, ignoring the NATO forces that, you know, if we bring them in, that's World War III. So ignoring that. Russians, of course, their analysts, their military folks, they can all have the same conversation, and they know full well what you and I have been talking about for weeks, if not months here. We have the military advantage. There's no way, maybe they say, that NATO is going to join in because nobody wants World War III. There's no way they could, even if they wanted to, because they lack the military hardware and warm bodies to put uniforms on. Their financial problems are overwhelming. Again, going back to the brief comments about Germany and France, they're falling apart economically. So to fund, sustain, and continue To be a threat, you have to actually be a threat. And I think it's, you know, paper tiger kind of stuff. Russia's calling the bluff, right?
Yeah, I do. I think it is. And you know, one of the things that President Trump has been, you know, threatening anyway, is that I will put all these secondary tariffs on China, India, Brazil, and more tariffs or sanctions on Russia as long as Europe stops buying oil and they also do all these secondary sanctions. Well, you had this past weekend, Slovakia and Hungary, who are the two biggest users of Russian fuel, said categorically they will not do it because it would be economic suicide.
Right.
For them to do so. So that is not going to happen. And then you have India saying basically the same thing, that even though you have these already have these 25% tariffs on us because we're buying Russian oil, it would be more costly for us to do what you say than to stop the Russian oil. So we won't. And in fact, in some categories, they've actually accelerated their purchase of Russian oil at a discounted price. So the very fundamental thing you want to happen to influence this economic side is not going to happen because the participants themselves won't comply. Therefore, there's no threat to Russia on that regard, and they're going to continue going with what we have. And now then we're talking about the capability of our defense industrial base and increasing all these categories of things. For the U.S., we want to accelerate it by two to four times in some categories, which is in one hand pretty good, but it'll take like into 2027 if all of the contracts are signed immediately, and so far almost none of them have. So you see that we just don't have the cards to play to force Russia to do anything.
Well, in defense of the countries that continue to buy Russian oil, last time I checked, Daniel Davis, the Chinese Communist Party represents the biggest existential threat to the United States of America. We're still buying their stuff and things, aren't we, Daniel? Aren't we?
Yeah. And we're still engaged in some forms of economic warfare with the tariffs and everything else. So, and that's not working out really great in any regard there either. So you're just not going to compel the behemoth of China because they have too many alternatives besides us. Yeah. So either way you look, it's not working out well.
All right, pivoting over to the war in Gaza, 20-point plan is going to solve everything. That was the hope of Donald Trump yesterday with Benjamin Netanyahu. Hamas has to give up all of its arms, its infrastructure, its tunnels. They all have to be destroyed. They promise additional humanitarian aid and economic development for Gaza, but Hamas can have no real connection with it. And they also have to give up all the hostages within 48 hours to make this come through to get a ceasefire. Wall Street Journal reporting that apparently Hamas has lost control of some of the groups holding them for weeks. And so it may be even a little difficult to deliver on freeing the hostages. Daniel, is this going anywhere? The notion of a Palestinian state is still an option in this 20-point plan. Surprising me that Israel would be even go along with something that makes it a possibility even.
Yeah, there's lots of landmines in this. I'll just tell you, I am incredibly eager and pray to God, literally, that this works, that the killing can stop, that we can start the process of finding an end to the war, not just a ceasefire, but an actually end by addressing the core issues that led to the war in the first place. But based on what the U.S. released from the Witkoff 21-point plan before the meeting that Netanyahu pointedly would not endorse before the meeting happened, and then what he said on the backside of the meeting with Trump are like about 70% the same, but that 30% that's different is pretty categorical and problematic. All of these global leaders, I just looked right before we came online here overnight, nearly everybody's universally saying they hope this works somewhere, but almost all of them, especially the Arab and even some of the European leaders, are still harping on a two-state solution as the ultimate objective. And you saw that Netanyahu in his UN speech categorically and pounding on the desk said there will be no two-state solution. So I don't know how you get there from here.
I know.
If we start with the end of the war, then let's work on the hard stuff later.
And to that point, I know you've seen the footage and the photographs. Gaza, it's like Dresden in World War II. I mean, it is a nightmare to behold. So I do.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, and that's why I say I want this to come to a merciful end, because there's starvation. There's sickness. People are dying of avoidable illnesses and stuff because there's no health care system. Kids are getting their limbs amputated without anesthesia. It is horrific. Ooh. And all of that stuff can come to an end. And I pray to God that they find the political will. And that's what it is on both sides. And by the way, there's a bunch of folks inside Netanyahu's government that are vehemently opposed to this. They want no ceasefire. They only want a military conquest. And they even add the West Bank into it. Ben-Gvir in particular, he sent that out on X as Netanyahu's talking about this. So it remains to be seen whether even inside his government he can bring this to fruition, even if he wants to.
Well, and real quickly before we part company today, Daniel Davis, and you can find him online, Daniel Davis Deep Dive, and I recommend you do that. A lot of countries stepping up saying we recognize a Palestinian state, or that's their desire. Has anybody picked out where geographically this is supposed to land, and where the Palestinian state's supposed to go if you ended up with a two-state solution, Daniel Davis?
Well, I mean, it's supposed to include portions of the current Gaza Strip and the West Bank, but that by itself is so convoluted, no one really knows that. But there's even a bigger problem of who's actually going to lead it, because, again, Israel has said categorically it's not Hamas and it's not the Palestinian Authority unless they are radically changed. And the conditions that they put for that radical change, it'd be hard for any people group to agree to. So you've also got that problem.
Hey, bring in the UN. They'll solve the problem, Daniel Davis.
Yeah, let's bring in the guy. That'll be easy, because all they got to do is because they got such a good track record.
Put their blue hats on and start running things. Sure. Daniel Davis Deep Dive. God bless you, sir. I appreciate you coming on the program and sharing your thoughts with us. It's always a wonderful experience. I look forward to next Tuesday.